You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. After months of talks, EU and UK negotiators have finally reached an agreement on phase one of the Brexit talks. But just how binding is all of this? Today, the IEA's chief economist and head of the Brexit unit, Julian Jessop, and digital officer, Madeline Grant, discuss the outstanding issues and the extent to which issues covered in phase one, like the Irish border, the divorce bill, and EU citizens' rights, have been resolved. They also look ahead, examining the key priorities for phase two and trade talks. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
So, Julian, after months of negotiations, the government has finally reached an agreement on phase one of the Brexit talks, covering issues like EU citizens' rights, the Ireland border, and the initial divorce bill. But how binding is all of this?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's debatable whether the agreements in phase one are legally binding. As it happens, though, I think this probably will never matter because the talks are likely to continue to progress. But for what it's worth, the report itself stated that the discussion represents agreement in principle on the three key issues of citizens' rights, Northern Ireland and the financial settlement. And the clear intention is to incorporate all these elements into the withdrawal agreement specified in Article 50. Nonetheless, there are a couple of important caveats. I mean, first of all, it's been noted at least twice that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. There's also an additional caveat that the whole agreement is conditional on making a start as soon as possible in 2018 on discussions around a transitional arrangement. So there's therefore a case for arguing that none of this is yet binding, particularly if the UK does exit without a withdrawal agreement, the so-called no-deal scenario. But I think in practice, there's enough agreement on these issues that the political will is strong enough for talks to continue, even if the legal technicalities aren't quite as nailed down as people would like. It's certainly hard to imagine a scenario where the Westminster government walks away from its commitments on avoiding a hard border in Northern Ireland, regardless of the Brexit process. I think that's a commitment that the Westminster government would absolutely want to meet.
But Northern Ireland then remains the key sticking point.
Yes, and this is probably the really big problem. There are arguably two conflicting positions reflected in the latest UK and EU statements. One is the acknowledgement that the UK is leaving both the internal or single market and the customs union, but also the commitment to avoid a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, meaning there'll be an absence of visible infrastructure such as customs posts and passport checks and so on. This is arguably difficult to reconcile because if it's possible to import goods into the UK that don't meet EU standards and then just push them across the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, that potentially compromises the EU as a whole. The UK's intention is to resolve these apparently contradictory objectives through the overall EU-UK trade relationship or by technical solutions. So that's things like electronic customs procedures, which don't require physical checks at the border. Failing that, the UK has said it will maintain full alignment with those rules of the internal market and the customs union that are necessary to prevent a hard border. Some people have interpreted that to mean that we'll never be remaining within the internal market and the customs union forever, but I think that's going too far. It depends on what those technical solutions are, it depends on the future relationship between the UK and the EU. It also depends on the possibility of some regulatory divergence between the north of Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, something that clearly has to be negotiated and agreed by Northern Ireland politicians, but is certainly a possibility. After all, there are already many ways in which Northern Ireland does differ from the rest of the United Kingdom. If there's some compromise deal that can be done, I'm sure it will be.
The major fracas that took place between the DUP and the Republic of Ireland itself was very much to do, by the looks of things, to do with the wording. And they've now found a wording of the text that seems agreeable to both parties. So I guess, that does bode well for future negotiations.
Yes, I mean, of course, it is an enormous fudge. If you ask, two lawyers what regulatory alignment means, you're probably going to get three different answers or possibly none at all. I mean, clearly it's a term that's open to interpretation. What we can say is regulatory alignment doesn't mean having exactly the same rules. Indeed, if you look at the detail of the report published on the 8th of December, when referring to nuclear issues, it gave an example of how the UK could commit to a future regime that provides coverage and effectiveness equivalent to existing Euratom arrangements. So it doesn't mean necessarily exactly the same rules, but something that delivers the same outcome. And that was a possibility also raised by the Prime Minister herself in her in her Florence speech, emphasising that the UK doesn't want to abandon the sort of environmental protections and health and safety checks and so on that the EU has suggested. So it may well be that, you know, the regulatory divergence is limited to a few areas which are specific to the UK needs, but overall we're going to continue to track the regulatory regime of the rest of Europe fairly closely. That's good news to the extent that it will make it easier to get a trade deal, but it also, of course, is a concern for those that believe that we should be diverging more from the regulatory constraints of the EU to do our own thing. And it may also be a constraint when it comes to doing free trade deals with the rest of the world.
And Julian, how confident do you feel that the technological innovations that you're describing would actually be able to perform border checks and replicate the current arrangement?
Well, I'm pretty confident. I mean, first of all, in general, technology is moving on enormously quickly. If you look at, you know, Oyster cards on the underground or the prospect of having driverless cars within just a few years. So I think, you know, it's dangerous to underestimate the speed of technological change. And also a lot of the things that need to be enhanced exist already. For example, trusted trader schemes in Ireland itself, but also, you know, various forms of electronic border checks in other countries that, you know, don't have full trade agreements but nonetheless have fairly open borders. So I'm pretty optimistic a solution can be arrived at. The problem is more about, almost like, I hate to call it this, but the paranoia of those in Europe who think that the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland will become a backdoor for shipping in all sorts of things to the rest of the EU. I mean, in practice, there may well be an increase in smuggling under the new arrangements. But, you know, realistically, how much are people going to be able to ship across the border without somebody noticing? I think you need to be pragmatic and realistic about this. And the idea that border alone will lead to a fundamental compromise of the whole structure of the internal market, I think, is going completely over the top.
What are the other key sticking points, if any?
Well, the Northern Ireland question, I think, is the most difficult. The other two, at least, are relatively straightforward. I think that there's broad agreement on the best solution to the challenges raised by citizens' rights, for example. Basically, the UK and the EU have agreed to protect the existing rights of any citizen who is legally resident in either the UK or the rest of Europe at the time of withdrawal from the EU, in other words, 29th of March 2019. And I think that's something that was widely expected, but it's sensible. Similarly, on the financial settlement, obviously, some people object to the idea of paying any money at all, but the UK does seem to have kept the bill down. Principles that have been laid out seem fairly reasonable. And whatever the precise number, the more important point is that this is money that the UK would have had to pay anyway if it had remained a member. So it's not necessarily an additional cost of Brexit. The big sticking point, though, as you say, is the challenges posed by Ireland. And this could play out in any number of different directions. It certainly has the potential to shape Brexit for the whole of the United Kingdom. And here there are still quite a few questions still to be answered.
So you say that negotiators have agreed on the principles of the financial settlement. What does this mean exactly? Because Britain is keen to keep it below 40 billion. So in agreeing on the principles, are they agreeing the kind of methodology of what will be paid for and what won't be paid for?
Yes, at this stage, we can't put a precise number on what the bill is going to be. Indeed, it may well be another 10, 20, 30 years before we actually know what the final sum has been. There are a number of different elements to this. One is that the UK has agreed to continue making its annual contributions effectively until the end of 2020, which is the end of the current budget period, the so-called multi-annual financial framework. It's also agreed to pay its share of any bills that are falling due after that date. That partly includes the pension contributions, but more controversially, it includes the big lump of future payments known by the French term reste à liquider, which is basically payments that have been agreed but not yet made and may well be extending over the next several years, maybe even decades. That is particularly controversial because it does mean that the UK will be continuing to pay into the EU budget for years and, as I say, potentially even decades. But it does at least mean that there won't be a big upfront cost, and very quickly those sums will be overtaken anyway by the accumulated savings from stopping making the annual contributions, which will cease no later than 2020. So we'll still be ahead within a few years, even if, to start off with, we're going to continue to make large net contributions.
Was the decision to postpone some of these payments through reste à liquider, was that partly politically motivated so that we could be seen to be having a lower bill now and a bigger one in time to make things easier for negotiators?
Well, I think there's obviously a political advantage, but also a financial one. The political advantage, of course, is that, you know, it's rather like boiling a frog. You don't quite realise how much damage is being done because the temperature keeps being ratcheted up. And know, it could be a few billion 1 year, a few billion the next year. It's not so big a headline number. So politically, that makes sense, perhaps. But also financially, one of the problems with paying a big amount of money up front is some of that money might be contingent on something happening or not happening at some point in the future. So, for example, a lot of the money committed to the so-called res liquidae is dependent on other things happening. For example, the national government's concern being willing to make a contribution to, or planning regulations being approved for a big infrastructure project. So there would be a risk that you end up paying a large amount of money up front that actually you have to end up getting repaid at some point in the future. And there's also lots of nitty-gritty points of detail that leaving it a bit longer would help solve. For example, the appropriate discount rate used for calculating what your pension contribution should be. There's an advantage here for the UK in delaying those payments, because at some point in the future, the payments might be less than they would have been if we were paying them now.
In recent weeks, Tory rebels have succeeded in forcing through an amendment to the withdrawal bill, which essentially means that they'll now be given a further vote on the final Brexit deal. This is clearly being viewed as a major setback for the government. Is that a view that you share, or is it a lot of noise?
Well, I'm not sure it's a major setback for the government in practical terms. The government had pretty much promised a vote on the final deal. What it does suggest, though, is that confidence in those sorts of promises from the government is not high. You know, people actually want that to be written into law. The outcome is the same, and we always knew there was going to be a vote. It's just that the government has lost a little bit more credibility by having had this problem in the first place. I suspect, above all, it's been a problem of parliamentary management. I think arguably the government should have seen that there was strong support for having a vote formally written into law in the way that it now is, or will be. Rather than leaving it to a government promise. But the outcome is the same. We know there'll be a parliamentary vote now. We can just be a bit more certain about exactly the terms on which that vote will take place.
Yes. What are the repercussions for what's going on in Brussels now? I mean, surely it would be taken as a sign that Brexit can be halted. Could it encourage the EU to toughen its terms, thinking that, you know, if they do so, that we might drop the whole idea altogether?
Well, the bigger picture is that I still think there's very strong support for Brexit in the UK. It's been interesting looking at the opinion polls. If there were a referendum held again today, it might be very close again, and some of the polls suggest the vote will be to remain rather than to leave. But remember, most opinion polls didn't get the actual vote right last year either. I suspect there are plenty of shy leavers who are still reluctant to admit they're signing up to Brexit. But on the fundamental issues, you know, support for leaving the single market, scepticism about the customs union, I think to the extent people understand those issues, then they're just as willing to back the government line now as they were in the past. I'm not sure that makes a huge amount of difference, though, either way in Brussels. I mean, Europe still has its concerns about making sure that when the UK leaves, it doesn't get as good a deal as existing EU members might do. They obviously want to get as much money as possible in the financial settlement. They want to protect the Irish border. They want to protect citizens' rights. So I'm not sure the sort of day-to-day ebb and flow, the noise, as you put it, of UK politics is really that important to them.
Yes. Of course, it's a time that having a united government seems more valuable than ever. But I guess you're right that there is this constant ebb and flow that, in the grand scheme of things, we'll probably won't even be talking about this in a couple of weeks in the news cycle.
Well, if we're talking about a united government, it's worth saying we don't really have a united opposition either. I think, you know, Labour Party position on Brexit is extremely hard to pin down. I mean, they're saying that they want to, you know, have the benefits of single market membership and being part of the customs union, which is rather like motherhood and apple pie. And I think everybody wants the benefits. The question is, what costs are they willing to pay? There have been any number of conflicting comments from within the Labour Party on this. If you look at other political parties, there are some like the Lib Dems who'd rather Brexit doesn't happen at all, but that's hardly a big vote winner for them at the last election. So I think it's fair to say that the UK government doesn't quite know what it wants, but there's nobody presenting a clear alternative other than not proceeding with Brexit at all, which is something that the vast majority of the British public, I think, would find unacceptable.
Yeah, actually, interestingly enough, when you mentioned the polls earlier, one recent one that I saw that's showing that the public still overwhelmingly does want Brexit, by John Curtis, who is pretty much the only pollster that did predict the last few round of elections. So the evidence is even stronger, I guess. Phase one is over. What will be the key issues for phase two?
Well, ideally, of course, the UK and the EU would now move immediately to finalise a comprehensive free trade deal, which could be implemented in time for March 2019. And in principle, this should be straightforward, because after all, both countries or regions already start from a position of near frictionless trade and convergence. In practice, though, I think that's clearly unlikely to happen. After all, it's taken us an awful long time just to get to the end of phase one, let alone to think about how quickly phase two might be completed. There's still a lot of uncertainty on the part of the UK about exactly what sort of future relationship we're willing to have. You know, this compromise between the benefits and the costs of single market and customs union membership. And looking at the position of the EU, clearly they don't want to offer us quite as good a deal as we've got now because they want to make sure that members of the EU have a better deal than those who aren't. Plus, there's, I think, an overly legalistic approach that many EU politicians take. I mean, some of them have even said that we can't even begin to negotiate a free trade deal until we've actually left the EU, which is pedantic, but typical of the approach that some of them favour. So I think it's clear we won't be ready to jump straight to a free trade deal in March 2019. We therefore definitely need, a transitional period, perhaps the 2 years that the Prime Minister has suggested. Over that transition period, we're probably going to need to maintain something as close to the current status quo as possible so that provides maximum business certainty and means there's only one change of regime when we do eventually leave. But that also, of course, raises loads of questions. To what extent are we going to have to continue to accept the rules of the single market and the customs union? We would presumably still have to continue paying into the EU budget. Perhaps that's less of a concern now that the financial settlement effectively achieves that. But what free trade deals will be able to do? Will we be able to negotiate free trade deals with the rest of the world, or would you have to wait until we finally left the customs union as well? Lots of potential red lines and unknowns there that still need to be resolved, but at least those negotiations can now start sooner rather than later.
Yes, and I suppose even a two-year period in which we're not able to take advantage of all the opportunities of being fully outside of the EU, then still a two-year period, it will be over and we can start to embrace the world after that time.
I think realistically that's right. I mean, two points. First of all, as far as regulation is concerned, to begin with, we're simply incorporating all of the EU regulations into UK law anyway as part of the EU withdrawal bill. So there's no intention to junk all the EU regulations on day one anyway. I mean, it'll be probably some years before we get round to reviewing any of those. And as far as doing free trade deals with the rest of the world is concerned, I think the priority to begin with has to be to protect the relationship we've already got with the EU and also those trade agreements that we have with third countries by virtue of our membership of the EU. That's already a pretty full agenda. It may well take a few years longer before we really get around to doing free trade deals with the rest of the world anyway. It's not as if there's going to be a whole pile of them ready to sign and implement on day one after we leave. So as long as in, say, 3, 4, 5 years' time, we can start making meaningful progress on reviewing those regulations and signing free trade deals with the rest of the world, I think a hiatus of 2 years to get the transition right is another one of these prices that's worth paying.
Yes. And what of the final deal? Because obviously we're in very uncharted territory here. There are no precedents for a country departing the EU, and it looks increasingly likely that customs union and single market are off the table. What kind of precedents are we looking at here, and what could the final deal start to look like?
Well, if we start from the position that we're leaving both the single market and the customs union, that does knock out some of the alternatives that have been suggested in the past. So, for example, membership of EFTA, similar to that which Norway has. So Norway is in the single market but outside the customs union. I think that's going to be off the table. Instead, though, I think there's a clear consensus building around the idea of a Canada plus deal, as it's sometimes described. So the EU-Canada deal already looks fairly attractive. In particular, it gets rid of almost all of the tariffs on goods in trade. It does provide only limited coverage of services, but I think there are good reasons to expect the UK to get a better deal there than Canada has done. For a start, the UK is a far more important market for the rest of the European Union than Canada is, so its bargaining power is greater. For example, the EU28 as a whole, so actually even includes the UK, exported goods worth only 28 billion euros to Canada in the first 9 months of this year, whereas the rest of the EU exported goods worth 220 billion to the UK, so a whole order of magnitude different there. Similarly, when you look at services, the city is potentially a far more important market and provider of capital for the rest of the European Union than the Canadian financial sector is ever going to be. That has pros and cons. Obviously, the EU is quite keen to attract some of that business away from London and Edinburgh to Frankfurt, to Paris and so on. But equally, European businesses are very dependent on the critical mass that only the City of London can currently provide. So I think taking all of those factors into account, the UK can get a better deal than Canada has done. If you add on that top of that too, the legal issues. I mean, the EU is obliged to do good deals with near neighbours. That's actually Article 8 of the Lisbon Treaty. So there are all sorts of reasons to expect the UK to get a better deal than Canada has done. So Canada plus or Canada plus plus is probably where we're going to end up.
For more blogs, podcasts, films and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.